There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast, the free lunch. You know why we call it Free Lunch Podcast, Greg?
I think it's because, you know, it doesn't cost you anything to listen to it.
Yeah, it's free.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah.
The only thing that's it's costing us is our time, but we enjoy doing this.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep. That's right.
So, Greg, we had an interesting week, couple weeks here.
Yeah.
Markets and headlines and all that stuff.
Yep.
And we're not obviously the first people to talk about markets and the economy and behavioral impacts of investing, right?
No, we're not.
But we are not the pioneers in these areas.
We could be one of thousands and thousands, in fact.
I'm sure there are
yep.
thousands and thousands. Although I would say that I think ours is probably in the top 10.
Well, if not in the top three.
The self-proclaimed best podcast on investing in Canada.
Exactly.
But there is a guy named, or there was a guy named Jonathan Clements,
mm-hmm.
who yep. was a longtime Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist.
Yep.
And Jonathan wrote over 1,000 articles between 1994 and 2008. That's a mm-hmm. lot of articles.
That's a lot of articles. Yeah, and he just passed away this past weekend.
Yeah, it was cancer, right?
Young guy, 62 years old.
Yep. So his style was to blend practical financial advice with human behavior and life lessons, which yep. really aligns with what we're trying to do as well.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
And his framing, his columns mattered because he was writing during some pretty pivotal times, like things that you and I lived through as well.
Yep.
The dot-com boom and bust.
Yep.
9/11, the housing bubble, the Great Recession. I mean, those are all things that you went through in your career.
Well, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And had kind of a profound impact on how we approached investing
yeah.
after having gone through them.
Well, I ran into this today where I had a product manufacturer trying to convince me that we should use his products.
Yeah.
And of course he had some great story of how wonderful they were and high rates of return. And
yeah.
And I actually told him, like, look, we are skeptical when we hear things like this because we went through the Great Recession.
Yep.
We're not that old to go through the Great Depression.
No.
But so we're skeptical when we hear things that just sound too good to be true, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Jonathan would write about these things too, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So what were some of the core themes in his Wall Street Journal articles?
So there's a few themes that we thought we might hit on. And again, you know, this is our homage to this guy because he wrote things in a way that, you know, it just made sense
yeah.
for individuals and cut through a lot of the garbage.
Mm-hmm.
So he was one of the early advocates of index funds.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a lot about index funds. So let me talk about a few themes and then we'll go into each one in detail. So one was the case for index funds. Another one was the impact of costs and fees.
Mm-hmm.
on investment returns and transparency, the importance for transparency. And lastly, he talked about behavioral finance kind of long before it was popular. So before Kahneman and Thaler are two people we've talked about on this podcast,
yep.
two of the leaders in behavioral finance, he wrote about biases, you know, things like overconfidence, chasing performance and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. so those are a few of the themes. So let's just, you know, go into each one in specific. So first of all, the case for index funds. And so his view was that keeping costs low was the single biggest advantage for investors. You know, and he said, and this is a quote of his, "The great irony is that the less we pay Wall Street, the more we keep for ourselves."
Mm-hmm.
And the more, you know, the more we like it, the more they hate it, basically. You know, and that's one of the things we've talked about over the years is that costs and fees, you know, are paid by the investor and detract in a very significant way from, you know, from their returns.
Yeah.
You know, and when you think about it, and when I started in the business, typical management expense ratios on mutual funds were between 2.5% and 3%.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just imagine 3% compounded annually over 30-year or 40-year investing time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive impact, you know, and so he was one of the early ones to talk about index funds. And again, the key thing about index funds without even dealing with, you know, the investment strategy itself. It's just far less costly.
Yeah.
And over the years, of course, the mutual fund companies have embraced the concept of lower fees because they've had to. Mm-hmm. And many of the funds that, you know, that we use and that you recommend to clients are as inexpensive or even more so than index funds.
Well, and there's another cost there too, that because everybody focuses on MER of a fund, right?
Yep.
I say, well, you know, if I just own these 12 stocks, I don't pay ongoing MER.
That's right.
But there's an implicit cost to that.
Sure.
Right. And that would come from performance. Right?
Exactly.
So yeah, we're obviously big proponents of keeping costs low.
Yep.
The less you pay, the more you keep. The more mm-hmm. you keep, the happier you are. Sounds like a rhyme, right? Like a children's rhyme.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should write a children's book.
Yeah. Hickory dickory dock. The less you pay in fees. Yeah.
So you know, the second theme, you know, cost, fees, and transparency, which obviously the index fund discussion blends right into, is just that, as you said, there's hidden fees. You know, and hidden expenses that you don't see. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the fees, the hidden costs of being overly concentrated, let's say, in too few stocks, or the costs of trading within mm-hmm. mutual funds and the tax consequences of active trading. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of things that you don't see, but in many cases they matter more than the things you do see.
Yeah.
And those are those hidden costs.
Yeah.
And then the last thing about behavioral finance is that, you know, he was one of the early ones to talk about how, you know, you can be your worst enemy when it comes to investing because we're so affected by what we see on television or what we hear on television or how we react to market situations like you mentioned, like the global financial crisis, the, mm-hmm. you know, the technology bubble and subsequent bust, that kind of thing.
For sure.
And so... So one of the things, so these are just some of his quotes on those themes we've been talking about. He says, the less money you pay Wall Street, the more you keep for yourself. Costs are certain, future returns aren't. That's just making the point that, you know, some people say, well, it's worth it to spend, you know, 2.5% or 3% in fees because just look at the performance, you know, of this particular fund.
Yeah.
And that performance may not continue, but the fees certainly will.
Well, and one of those things, and I know you're going to get into another quote, but... One of the things that we're tackling with these days is structured notes
yep.
that are issued by all of the banks.
Sure.
They're sold at branch levels and the full service brokerages. And
yep.
it's a big part of the offering now from mm-hmm. those dealers.
Yeah.
And I had somebody call me the other day and ask me about these structured notes. Mm-hmm. Right. And he said, well, apparently there's no cost to buy these things.
Right.
I said, well, I mean, there's a commission on that thing yeah. between 2.5% and 4%.
Yeah.
So that cost has to be paid somewhere.
Yes.
Right? So yeah. it's not maybe as transparent as they would think.
Well, it sort of reminds you of the old days of deferred sales charges when you bought mutual funds. Mm-hmm. You know, the investor would buy the funds, the advisor would get paid 5% up front, and then an ongoing trailer fee of 0.5%. And you'd tell the investor, well, you're not really paying anything.
Well, I wouldn't tell them. You're saying other.
I'm saying, well, that's right. You know, but the story would be, hey, you're not paying anything
yeah.
because you're not paying the 5%. But of course you are. It's coming out of the,
yeah.
you know, cutting them out of the returns of the funds.
Yeah.
You know, and the fund company hopes to make that back through their MERs mm-hmm. over the period of time that they required you to stay in that fund without, you know, without penalties.
For yeah, living. They're not charities. They're not giving you these products for free.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, sorry, let's go on to another quote.
Okay, so he said, trying to beat the market is like trying to run up a down escalator. You might make progress for a while, but in the long run, the math wins.
Yeah.
You know, and he believed very strongly, like it's all about the math. And yeah. in that case, you know, sort of, yeah, trying to beat the market is just not a good idea. And then he says, your single best strategy isn't chasing winners. It's avoiding unnecessary costs.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another thing that we've talked about in the past, you know, is kind of like trying to beat the market, for example. You know, if you fail, there's a time cost. Mm-hmm. You know, if you underperform the market because of a bad year or a bad selection of individual stocks or other investments, well, then you now have to do better than the market in the future mm-hmm. just to catch up to where you would have been if you just got market returns over the same period of time.
Yeah.
So those are those unnecessary costs or time costs if you're wrong.
Yeah. And they're big.
Yep.
They're bigly.
Bigly.
All right. So some other selected articles and insights from Mr. Clements.
Yep.
One was the high cost of being human.
Yep.
And this article explores how emotions and life events can derail even the most well-built portfolios, right?
Yep.
So the talking points that he would suggest would be that investors trade based on headlines instead of sticking to strategy.
Yeah.
And that we see that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're surrounded by headlines always. That's right. And the headlines change, but the root story doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, it's like that. We did a podcast talking about that not too long ago when it's, you know, how do stocks pick you? How do stocks pick investors?
Yeah.
You know, and that's how they do it. They do it, you know, through headlines or through price action or something like that.
Yeah. Another article he wrote was why we can't resist performance. So just what you were talking about. So there is this idea that you can, you know, buy last year's best performing fund or stock or ETF and you'll get some better performance going forward. And you remember, not to pick on them, but I'm going to pick on them, the Scotia Leaders portfolio.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that one?
Sure. This is a strategy that, or a program that came out when I was just a newly minted investment advisor. And the strategy was as follows. There was a fellow by the name of Ranga Chand, who analyzed mutual funds and mutual fund performance. And so he was put in charge of selecting 5 Canadian and 5 global equity mutual funds to include in this global portfolio of funds. Mm-hmm. And what they would do is they started by looking at, you know, sort of last year's top performing funds and buying those five Canadian, 5 global. And then at the end of each year, subsequent to that, they would rebalance the portfolio by selling the underperforming funds and then replacing them with the newest year's best performing funds.
Yeah.
So
this is not a recipe for success.
So in a sense, every year you would buy last year's winners and sell last year's losers.
Right.
You know, which totally failed to account for the fact that, you know, in general, and we know this now through research, is that first of all, sort of outperformance is not persistent through time.
Yeah.
And generally, and even if you might get 1 or 2 or 3 years of outperformance, eventually it will revert. Mm-hmm. And so probably a better strategy in the end would have been to just buy, you know, 10 mutual funds based on criteria, you know, that included more than just performance and just holding on to them forever.
Yeah.
And that probably would have resulted in better returns.
If I had to guess, I bet a even better strategy for returns would have been sell last year's winners and buy last year's losers.
That could
because
be.
You'd have mean reversion.
Yep.
And yeah, you'd probably would have picked up some alpha there is the term.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So one of the quotes that he mentioned about that is the temptation to chase last year's hot fund is irresistible and almost always disastrous.
Yeah.
So just what you talked about.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about the next one. So Wall Street's worst enemy is math. You mentioned this already.
That's right. Yeah, that gets back to the whole idea of compounding, you know, and so when we talk about compound returns from saving, mm-hmm. you know, getting people to start saving early, even in their early 20s, as soon as they have any money, then there's money to put away, even if it's a small amount. But the benefits of compounding over long periods of time, you know, can be extremely beneficial, which is one of his key themes. But the same thing happens with costs. And so when you compound those costs and fees, then it's probability and not, you know, not hype that actually determines the outcomes. And so when you think about it, markets might be unpredictable in the short run, but the math is relentless.
Yeah.
You know, and you're always up against math.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's funny. I just met with somebody last night, newer client to us, person I've known a long time. And they talked about, is this a good time to invest? You know, the market's at an all-time high.
Yeah.
And I looked them straight in the eyes and I said, milk production's also at an all-time high.
Yeah.
So, because as you say, the long-term math would suggest that even if you're investing at a peak, as long as you're invested and stay invested, you can go through a whole cycle and come out way further ahead.
Yeah.
Even if you're invested at arguably the wrong time.
And I believe, you know, in one of our podcasts, maybe years ago even, we talked about how the worst market timer in the world still got very good, you know, results, meaning that if every year you know, the worst market timer bought at the very peak of the market, you know, and subsequently there were downturns or what have you. But if he just invested at the peak of the market in every year, he would have had very decent returns over a long period of time.
Yeah, but had to stay invested.
But had to stay invested, absolutely.
Yeah. So there's a quote on that that he shares. Fear and greed aren't just market forces. They're personal forces we all have to wrestle with.
Yep.
And we've seen that so many times over the years.
Yeah.
When markets are down, there's the phone rings a bit more.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm nervous. Maybe we should get out. Right? When markets are up, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
We should be investing more. Right?
Yep.
It's very cyclical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, another one of the recurring themes that showed up in some of his words were, you know, sort of the concept of how money and happiness, you know, sort of overlap or or combine. And he wrote a lot of essays on what money can and cannot buy, you know, and so here are some of his quotes. Money can't guarantee happiness, but it can buy freedom, security, and time with the people you love. The best investment isn't a stock or a bond. It's the life you build with the people who matter. And this is an interesting one. Don't measure your wealth by your portfolio balance. Measure it by the number of mornings you wake up excited to start the day.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And that actually aligns with, we've had a few other sort of behavioral people on the show, Dr. Daniel Crosby, Brian Portman, Carl Richards, Megan Lertz. The recurring theme that I hear from all of these people is that money is just a tool, right? To actually do things that drive happiness.
Right.
Right. So yeah it's, I think people kind of look at money the wrong way sometimes.
Exactly.
Okay. Where are we going with this?
Well, just one last area that he wrote on extensively, and then we can go into some of the other things that are just, he mentioned, and I think they're different because he took a bit of a different look to certain things. But first of all, he talked about on retirement, you know, on planning. He wrote a lot about that, and it's relevant to me, of course, having retired last year.
Yeah. How's that going for you?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Still retired.
Yeah, good.
Except I'm doing podcasts. But he said, retirement isn't about a number on a statement. It's about having reliable income to live the life you want. And I think I've heard this one before. The goal of financial planning isn't to die rich. It's to live richly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And cash flow is king. You can't spend average returns. You spend actual dollars that hit your account. Mm-hmm. You know? And so, yeah. So you can't rely on hoping for average returns in the future. It's, you know, you need to plan income for retirement and live according to those, you know, those plans.
Sure. Now, a majority of these articles were written, you know, 10 to 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess the question we might get is, are they relevant today? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, of course. All of those themes are relevant. There's been this index fund revolution, right? Which started as like sort of a one-off idea, I don't know, 3 decades or 4 decades ago.
Yeah.
And really has taken over the headlines. And the funny thing about index funds themselves is a lot of index funds or ETFs are actually just wrappers of maybe a mutual fund of the same portfolio.
Yeah.
But they're just allowed to sell, trade intraday.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously there is a huge amount of money flowing into ETFs. We like to see that.
Yep.
Because it removes this concentration idea of, well, which stock to buy, right? Which sector to focus on, right?
Yep.
Another relevant area would be, as you mentioned, fee compression and fiduciary standard.
Mm-hmm.
This is huge. This has changed so much since you and I started.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, you know, we were licensed originally as salespeople.
Exactly.
Like that is the actual license.
Yes.
Right?
And many advisors still are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not a portfolio manager,
right,
you don't technically have a fiduciary duty.
That's right.
And so your job is to sell products.
That's right. And without a fiduciary standard, it means you're not obliged to act in the investor's best interest.
Yeah. And there's a lot of press about this these days and, you know, about banks and broker dealers and how they use their sales force to sell proprietary products.
Yep.
And anyways, I won't beat this one to death, but I'll just say that fiduciary standard is really important. We obviously are fiduciaries, and so it kind of doesn't matter on our end. You know,
yep.
We have to put clients' needs first.
Yep.
But just wanted to call that out.
For sure.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, life and money. So,
pardon me.
Do I say bless you or was that a cough?
That was a cough.
Do you say bless you for a cough?
Not typically, no, but.
Do you find sometimes you're confused? Did they cough or did they sneeze?
Sometimes it's hard to tell.
It is. Yeah, it
could be a snuff.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Anyways, back to life and money. So Jonathan's holistic approach just foreshadowed today's financial wellness movement.
Absolutely. You know, you think he was writing these things, you know, up till maybe 2008 when he did most of his writing. Mm-hmm. And now, including ourselves, I mean, the way we changed our business back in about the same time, 2008, 2009, around the GFC, mm-hmm. global financial crisis.
Yep.
Yeah, we sort of changed the way we approached the business as well.
Well, the GFC was a BFD.
It was. Yeah, it was for sure. And so when you go through those BFDs, you decide that maybe we need a different approach, a better approach.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was diagnosed with cancer a year ago or so, and he kind of reflected on his time, and, you know, and these are some of his quotes. After 1,000 columns, the lesson I keep returning to is simple. Save diligently, spend thoughtfully, and don't let money matter more than it should.
Right.
He's also said, I've spent my career writing about money, but the truth is money was never the main story. The real story is people, their hopes, their fears, their mistakes, and their dreams. And lastly, if my writing leaves readers with anything, I hope it's the sense that finance isn't about beating others. It's about building a life you won't regret.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit humbling, you know, when you think, you know, this is how we spend our lives, you know, and we're deeply enmeshed with investing and everything else that goes along with that. And in the end, it's not about the investing, you mm-hmm. know, it's about, you know, keeping things simple and helping people, you know, achieve their dreams.
Yeah, whatever those might be.
Exactly.
Yeah, and, you know, we've talked about this before, but we get questions that are technical in nature.
Yep.
You know, what's the price earnings multiple of the market, blah, blah, things like that, right?
Yep.
I think the root question is always, am I going to be okay?
Yeah.
Am I going to be able to provide the life that I want to live for myself and my family and those important to me?
Yeah.
And it's just framed in a way that sometimes is like, what's the EBITDA to cash flow?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I would argue most people don't know what EBITDA to cash flow is, but that's just another way of saying, am I going to be okay?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are some articles that we should cite.
Yep.
That we're looking at. One of the articles that really struck home for me, is that a term? Struck home?
Hit home. Yeah.
Hit home.
Yep.
Advice I'll pass along to my daughter, written mm-hmm. in 2006.
Yeah.
So in this article, he lists 9 lessons he hopes to pass to his daughter. And it's not all about investing. Much of it is about mindset, values, and principles. And so it is interesting because I have a daughter who's in business school.
Yep.
And I'm helping her understand things like economics. So I'm passing that along to her.
Yep.
But I actually hope that when she's done her education, she gets more out of it than just understanding the time value of money.
Yeah. Right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, and I was going through some of the things that he had spoken about, and one that, well, there's a couple that really were interesting to me. One, which is probably a little bit controversial, but he said that doing the thing you're passionate about is overrated for the young. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and you hear this a lot, you know, a lot of people say, look, you're young, you know, go find something to do that you're passionate about, because later on in life, you'll have these responsibilities. You might have, you know, you'll have a home, mm-hmm. you know, that you need to pay for, you'll have a mortgage, you'll have kids, et cetera. So now's the time when you're young and unattached and don't have those responsibilities to go do something you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. He actually felt that young people should focus on making and saving money, mm-hmm. you know, and by doing that and by starting early, then that would ensure that in the last quarter of their lives, they'd be able to, they'd have the freedom, you know, and the ability to go and do things that were fun and sort of enjoy, you know, the career more mm-hmm. rather than worrying about money.
Yeah.
You know, and it's an interesting approach. Not everybody's going to agree with that, of course, mm-hmm. but from a financial standpoint, it probably does make sense.
Well, it definitely is counterintuitive to myself as a parent, because, you know, I'm telling my kids, go find something that you enjoy doing.
Yep.
But, you know, I had this discussion with our lawyer the other day, and I said to him, at one point my daughter wanted to be a lawyer, but having gone through some legal stuff in the last year,
yep.
my view on the law profession is maybe skewed negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And our lawyer said, oh, I totally agree. You know, he said, it's actually a really hard job. I won't use the words that he used, but for the first 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that 10-year period, it opens up all these other things and you can then focus on things that you enjoy. And it's actually really wonderful.
Yeah.
No, so it was just putting in the time to get that base level. So that's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. The other thing that I love that he wrote is he says, want to enjoy life more? Put down the remote, back slowly away from the television, and do something where you're a participant, not an observer.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it's a very good thought because, mm-hmm. you know, more and more, particularly with streaming now, mm-hmm. you know, it's easy to get trapped into that sitting in front of the television for hours,
mm-hmm.
which I've done many times, you know, binging on, you know, 108, you know, episodes of something.
Mm-hmm.
And probably better to, you know, to use that time for something productive that you can enjoy and do with people.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, it's an interesting guy, philosophical guy as well, you know, for a financial writer.
Yeah.
As we've said, it goes far more than just, you know, investing.
Well, think about when you started. I mean, your job was to pick stocks.
Yep.
Right? And over time, you became aware that, no, your job is to help people solve problems.
Yep.
And the stocks are just a byproduct of being in the job, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think for the most, and I don't know Jonathan, I never knew him personally, but I certainly appreciate what he wrote about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jonathan Clements, look him up.
Yeah, why not?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas Wealth is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals and do not represent the opinion of Q Wealth as a firm.